only demonstrate my mastery of the obvious to say it was a great honor to be here. They know what a great honor it is. They don't offer you an honorarium, and they know you'll come just because it's the Harvard Law School. I only mention that because I heard that you all had to pay. Is that right? $2 for getting here? Ah, well, there's some funds need to be checked out, perhaps, though, because they don't go and form the honorary, I can tell you that. But they do give you a good dinner, so no complaints whatsoever. Every time I come to an institution of higher education, I realize what kind of lover's quarrel I still seem to carry on, having been 18 years at Yale, where I always thought of myself as pro-intellect but anti-intellectual, as it were. And I remember a conversation I had in Cuba with the Minister of Education, who in a former incarnation had defended the Bay of Pigs rather well, you might say. And I asked him, where'd you get educated? And he said, with a Jesuit, and a very good education it was. So I said, well, then you know the problem that we have in the religious community. How do you draw that line between education and indoctrination? And for just a brief moment, a defensive look flitted over his face and disappeared. Then he shrugged and he said, every country's education reflects that country's ideology. And I thought that was about as simple and probably straightforward and true a statement as you can make about education in those times, or perhaps still in our time. Because every country's education reflects that country's ideology, in Cuba, if, for instance, you graduate from the medical school, you start out in the barrios and you work your way gradually back to whatever flesh pots there are in Havana. And if you're a high school student, you may be plucked out of one of those barrios and you may be put in a barracks that's specially been built for you, and you work very hard at your studies in the morning and you cut cane in the afternoon. And because every country's education reflects that country's ideology, you have a serious civil liberties problem in Cuba. No question about it, particularly in institutions of higher education or in journalism. Now, because it's also true in our country that every country's education reflects that country's ideology, at a place like Yale, a place like Harvard, you've got a lot of freedom. And the press is relatively free. A.J. Liebling said, free press is a great thing if you can afford to own one. I know all the qualifications that go with saying we have a relatively free press. But we do have a relatively free press. But the freedom of Harvard and Yale faculty and students to say and think what they will is vastly exalted over any obligation to do any good to anyone. And I say that not to be mean, maybe to be mildly provocative, but mostly with the hope that when you get to New York and you join Airedale, Airedale, Whippet and Pug, we may get to see you in some of the causes which some of us still think are worth fighting for. Well, I was told I didn't give a title for tonight's talk, and I feel badly about that. So let me simply say, I think I'll get into the general area of religion and politics. I will not be, don't worry, too overtly religious. I know all of you are not believers, and I just want to remind you the important thing is not whether you believe in God, but whether God believes in you. And I'm sure God believes in a great many people who do not believe in God. St. Augustine said, there are as many sheep without the fold as there are wolves within. But let's not get into that. Let's get started. Let's get started by asking a question which is always a good one to ask several times a year, and that is, who tells you who you are? Or what tells you who you are? For instance, some people need money to tell them who they are. And this is poor folk as well as rich folk. They need money to tell them who they are. In about 6 weeks, we will go through the annual ritual of facing the IRS. And it's always instructive to see how those who can most easily afford to pay their taxes are most reluctant to do so. Now, they will give to charity, because charity reaffirms the notion, my money is power. Whereas taxes are like Delilah's shears, they come cutting at the root of the strength, revealing the underlying weakness. So some people need money to tell them who they are. Some people need institutions of higher education to tell them who they are. When I was chaplain these many years at Yale, it was natural that I should be asked to write letters of recommendation for students about to go on to graduate school who still didn't know that education kills by degrees, but they found out. And I must say, I wrote brilliant letters. For instance, to such august schools as the Columbia Law School or the Harvard Medical School, just to make sure we keep it all neutral, I would often write, this candidate will undoubtedly be in the bottom quarter of your class. But surely you will agree with me that the bottom quarter should be as carefully selected as the top. And for what would you be looking in the bottom quarter of the class if not for sterling extracurricular qualities so eminently embodied in this candidate? And I would say he's loving, conscientious, reliable, all those wonderful things that a human being is supposed to be and so rarely is. And then I would show the letter to the students. And you're not going to believe this, but invariably, their feelings were hurt. How do you know I'm going to be in the bottom quarter of the class? Well, the evidence is all in, isn't it? Well, you didn't have to tell them. Now, you see what I'm getting at? Just to get into a place like, yeah, you had to be what, in the 99.33 percentile of the whole country? And just to get into a place like the Harvard Medical School or the Columbia Law School, you then have to be in the 99 point, whatever it is, should we say, 6-6? But the fact that they were not in the 99.75 was enough to say to them that they were nothing. Never mind that I said, as human beings, they were fantastic. Such is the power of institutions of higher education to tell you who you are. Some people need enemies to tell them who they are. Blacks still need whites, and whites need blacks, unfortunately. New York, Jews and blacks provide quite a bit of identity to each other, alas, as do Hispanics with blacks, competing for who suffers the most, that sort of thing. I can remember when President Johnson announced his resignation in 1968, 500,000 people in the United States in the peace movement lost their identity. Who are we without the enemy? Fortunately, Nixon came along and restored their sense of well-being. They knew who they were, you see. Well, I'm not going to get down the list anymore. Some people need their sins to tell them who they are. The way some people treasure their sins, you'd think they were the holiest things in their lives. But there are a few people who would be generally religious people who would try to say at least that they like to believe it's God who tells them who they are. Now, who is then the God who tells them who they are? This is where religion and politics, seem to me, often get confused. I think you'd have to say that God is not neutral. You can't say God is, to a good Jew or a good Christian, is someone who sides with tyrants, because in that case, God would be malevolent. And God did not side with Marcus. Okay. Now, if you said, well, God is indifferent, then you'd be saying the same thing, wouldn't you? That God is malevolent because by not protesting the tyranny of tyrants, God is, in fact, he or she is supporting tyranny. It's only by a very clear understanding that God sides with the bruised and the poor and the oppressed that you, any Jew or Christian or Muslim, has any right to say that God is a God of justice. You can't have it both ways. God has to be a God, to be a God of justice, you have to say that God sides with the poor folk. And as a matter of fact, I suppose the most graphic definitions of religion to be found in Scripture are offered by the prophet Micah and Jesus. Prophet Micah said, and what does the Lord require of thee but to do justice, and to love kindness, or mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. And Jesus really spelled that out when he said that it is up to religious folk to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, heal the sick, and visit those in prison. They're talking about fairness, aren't they? They're talking about kindness, they're talking about self-giving, and this is something blacks always understand, that's why blacks never have problems with religion and politics. Because when blacks are talking about mixing religion and politics, they're talking about rights! And rights are inclusive. Dogma is exclusive. Falwell is always injecting dogma into politics, dogma which is exclusive because Jews do not believe the way he does on, for instance, the question of abortion. But everybody has to believe, at least in theory, what the blacks are saying when they're talking about rights. There the problem is not persuading people that all people are created equal, but making people feel the monstrosity of inequality. But when blacks mix religion and politics, they're talking about justice. So I think it's quite right of Bishop Tutu to say, when the elephant has his foot on the tail of the mouse, that's one of his favorite metaphors, or to say, when the North American shark is eating Latin American sardines, to use an image from a former president of Guatemala, el tiburón norteamericano está comiendo las sardinas de Latinoamérica. We may try to be neutral, but clearly God is on the side of the mice and the sardines. Now, this is very clearly put forth in all prophetic literature, and in the 22nd chapter of Jeremiah, the prophet is mercilessly attacking the king of Judah, rather meanly so, by comparing him to his father. And he says, did not your father eat and drink and do justice and righteousness? He judged the cause of the poor and needy. Is not this to know me, says the Lord? And those of you who have been in Central and Latin America have seen time and again posters in churches or in church offices that says, conocer a Dios es obrar la justicia. To know God is to do justice. And I think this implacable moral imperative to do justice is the kind of religion which politics desperately needs if it's going to have any reflection of morality. Now, that is, seems to me, is fairly obvious. But now we have to go on to differentiate charity from justice. Certainly the churches in this country and America as a whole is long on charity but short on justice. And there's a good reason for this. If you feed the poor, and we do so to the tune of $100,000 a year at Riverside Church, we're big on charity. And we get a lot of credit for our food pantry. But when we stand up and wonder aloud, vigorously, and with breathtaking regularity, why in the richest country in the world there is need for this kind of poverty, you're no longer a saint. Now you're a martyr. But the prophet did not say, let charity roll down like mighty waters. Said, let justice roll down like mighty waters. And Lord knows the churches in this country, to a lesser degree the synagogues, I think, but the churches in this country are guilty of what Marxists have accused us of being time and time again, namely, and not of being, but of having a vested interest in unjust structures which then produce victims to whom we then can pour out our hearts and charity. Now, when you start to think of it, church folk aren't the only folk that have to worry about that. So do shrinks. So do psychiatrists. Because all these alienating structures are producing all these victims. I would suggest that this country, which is getting increasingly polarized between the poor and the rich, over here on the poor side you have a support structure which is being dismantled rather rapidly, but which is the welfare structure. Whereas what the rich over here, they have their support structure, a whole bunch of psychiatrists who have a vested interest. One could argue, I'm not saying intentionally they want these, you know, alienating structures and this, all this rat race stuff to go on just so that they can get more clients. I'm not saying that. But one could just as well argue, as Marxists would, that they too have a vested interest in unjust structures. In other words, you can't allow charity to go bail for justice. It's not the same thing. And we're very prone to do this in this country. Another way of looking at it is to fail to see the place of justice in human rights. Now, when Americans talk of human rights, they immediately think of Sharansky. Only Sharansky, at last, thank God, has been liberated. Now they'll probably think about Sakharov, and I'm not minimizing that at all. It is terrible what they do to individuals in the Soviet Union like Sharansky and Sakharov. No question about it. But that's not the full scope of human rights, as most folk outside this country understand it. In fact, I'd say human rights really divide themselves rather neatly into two groups. You have, on the one hand, civil rights, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom that a people as a whole, like the Philippines, have to wrest from the government, like Marcos. But then there are other rights. What should we call them? Subsistence rights, social, economic rights, the right to food, the right to eat, the right to minimal housing, the right to minimal medical care and good education. Those are rights that one segment of the population, as a rule, has to wrest from another segment of the population and with the help of the government. Now, it is interesting, dear lawyers and lawyers-to-be, to note that food, the right to food, doesn't have nearly the legal protection that free speech has. In fact, it hasn't any at all. You are free to starve in this country. There's no legal protection to speak of. Because it hasn't been recognized the same moral right as free speech. But see, in places like Cuba, they think very differently. The Sandinistas think very differently. In a country where the average income is $783 a year, and where all 3 million of them constitute a great threat to the national security of the United States, as we've been told. But see, in places like that, the subsistence and the economic rights are considered very important. And when you get a Russian to really open up and stop being so polite, you have a full-blown conversation with one side saying, look at what you do in the way of violation of civil liberties, and the other side comes back and says, do you think we have homeless in the streets of Moscow? Do you think we don't provide basic medical attention to the poor? Look at what you do to the elderly and the poor, and so forth. So if we're going to talk about justice, if we talk about human rights, we've got to remember there's got to be more justice. And I would suggest that for dignity to be talked about with any real integrity, countries that are politically democratic, like eminently the United States, have to move in the direction of economic democracy. I mean, when you look at New York, New York's looking like a medieval city more and more, you know. Half the people in furs and the other part in rags and paper. We have 30,000 millionaires in New York City and twice that number of homeless. That's the way things are dividing. I took an East German pastor around New York once and showed him all the glories and tribulations of the city, and he said, you know, I'm not a communist, but New York would make me one. So all this is to say that a political democracy like ours, I think, has to move in the direction of justice if we're going to talk about human dignity with some integrity, and countries like the Soviet Union and China and Cuba have to start moving more in the direction of political democracy if they're going to be able to talk about human dignity with any kind of integrity. Now, I'm not going to labor this, but I do think President Bach made a very fine statement when he talked about an over-lawyered society, or more accurately, a society where the rich have far more benefits of legal assistance than do the poor. In the 60s, at least, there was a lot of money for legal aid. Public defendant programs had lots of money. Now, those of you who want to work in legal aid or in public defendant programs really have to hustle to get the money for it. I think you should hustle for it. I think you ought to go to the churches and tell them what you want to do and ask them to give you some money. You ought to go to the synagogues and tell them what you want to do. He says you'll do their work for them in the legal field. That is the work of justice, which has to be part of every church or synagogue's work. All right. Now, let me go on quickly to say, I stress this justice issue not only for the sake of the poor, but for the sake of the rich. I'm impressed that in 1945, when this country was the indisputable number one country in the world, and there wasn't even a number two around, everybody knew the United States, America is the number one, powerful, richest, and we like to think, of course, the most virtuous, which wouldn't leave anything for any other country. I've always thought we ought to not push that one too far. But we certainly were the number one in terms of riches and power. At that time, our number one playwright, Eugene O'Neill, said in an interview with the New York Times that he, quote, worked on the theory that the United States, instead of being the most successful country in the world, is the greatest failure. Its main idea, he went on, is that everlasting game of trying to possess your own soul by possession of something outside it. That's something when the number one player out of your country says that. And he went on to say the United States was the clearest example of what was meant by that scriptural statement, what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and forfeit and lose his soul? We can't argue that affluence buys morale. It doesn't work that way. I call to testify the Reader's Digest, because that's a publication that has probably warmed the cockles of more middle-class hearts than any other publication in America. The magazine is generally viewed as comfy, earnest, a staunch defender of the national faith. And a couple of years ago, the Reader's Digest, an issue, featured the following five articles. How to Stay Slim Forever. Five Ways to Stop Feeling Tired. How to Get Your Way. How Safe Are the New Contraceptives. And What It Takes to Be Successful. Now, it would appear that the editors had concluded that their millions of readers were, consecutively, fat, lazy, frustrated, lascivious, and unsuccessful. Now, the thought that we might indeed be a nation of autoerotic stumblebums does have, as they say in the legal profession, a chilling effect. So, I would argue very strongly, from basic religious and humanitarian reasons, that justice has to be put high on the agenda of this country. Now, that relates very directly to some foreign policy issues. When you stop to think about it, the United States foreign aid in country after country is helping the rich to become richer, the poor to become poorer, and the military to become more powerful. Which, when you stop to think of it, is a pretty accurate reflection of what's going on at home. Now, a case in point would be what's going on in El Salvador. Now, obviously, that's a justice issue at home, because we are spending $1 million a day now to keep that war going, and that's where most of that money is going. If any of you have done your homework on that, you know that help to the poor and needy does not get very far to the poor and the needy. We're putting in $1 million a day keeping that war going. Now, the government position, of course, is that war in El Salvador is largely inspired and sustained by outside forces, namely Cuba and the Soviet Union. But if, as Carlos Fuentes, Mexican diplomat writer, once pointed out, if Cuba was somehow miraculously to sink gently beneath the waves, if the Soviet Union were to shrink to the size of medieval Novgorod, the conflict would continue, because it is indigenous. You simply can't have a revolt without revolting conditions. The fire won't spread unless the wood is dry. It's only when the oligarchs are very few that the guerrillas become many. And so not only is it a justice issue because it's taking money away from our homeless and our poor, but it's also a form of eradicating poverty by killing poor people. That's really what it amounts to. And whatever one, whatever one's solution is, and I think it has to be sharing of power, one's concern has to be very genuine from a religious point of view when you are killing people. And when you arrogate to your own government the right to decide who lives, dies, and rules in another country. Now, of course, the same thing is true in a slightly different way in Nicaragua. What really grieves me about Nicaragua is the obvious pride in our country when we are fast becoming outcasts among our allies. None of the Latin American countries, the exception of Paraguay and Chile, and these are foreign minister levels who've spoken out now in favor of the Contadora process, and so have all Central American countries. And Costa Rica today admitted that the Contras were operating out of Costa Rica and set up with Managua some system of border patrol. That came over the news this afternoon. And the 13 or 14 countries of Western Europe in the economic community have all disagreed with President Reagan's analysis of what's going on. There's not a single country in the world that thinks our national security is threatened by tiny Nicaragua. All of them are appalled at the atrocities of the continent. Not a one of them has signed on to President Reagan's embargo. Not a one of them. And Spain and Canada and Sweden and other countries have simply stepped into our place as buyers of American goods. Even China now trades with Nicaragua. Now, that takes a lot of pride. I imagine some of you know American history better than I do, but I would venture, you can tell me afterwards if I'm wrong, that never in history has an American president veered so radically from the mildest admonitions of all Americans alive. Now, when our pride, swollen faces, close up our eyes, it's got to be a matter for the religious community. We're not saying we know what the answer is necessarily, but we certainly know that that's always a danger, pride of power. Ezekiel laments over Tyre, your heart was proud because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. All who know you are appalled at you. You have come to a dreadful end. Now, that's the kind of thing that everybody's got to be concerned, obviously, with. Now let me just say a few last words about the Soviet Union, which is obviously a terribly important thing. I must say, I'm old enough now so that I can not have to be too tolerant and too patient. And when I am with my fellow pastors, and they say, well, Bill, you know, I'm no great prophet, but I'm a good pastor. I don't waste any more time now. I say, you're a lousy pastor. But I know exactly what you're saying. You're saying you don't deal with controversial issues? Well, you tell me as a good pastor, then, if you think the Cold War is good for warm Christian hearts. Or you tell me that you don't have to deal with homosexuality when it's a thorn in the flesh of this whole country. You can't be a good pastor and not deal with these issues. Now, what are the main things we have to say about the Soviet Union? I think the first thing that we all have to remember is that they live, they breathe, they bleed, they have children for whom they have aspirations, just as we have children for whom we have aspirations. That's the first thing. From a religious point of view, they're our brothers and sisters. That's the way God made us. Christian point of view, Christ died to keep us that way, keep us that way. Our sin is only, we're constantly putting asunder what God himself has put together. Now, that's on the one hand. On the other hand, you can't say that it's that easy to love your brothers and sisters, or it's that easy to love a government that is clearly cruel and unjust to millions of its own inhabitants and to millions of others outside its borders in Eastern Europe. So let's not be sentimental about this. So how, then, are we going to relate to the Soviet Union without approving or in any way supporting the obvious cruelty of the Soviet government? Now, St. Augustine once said a very wise word, which is perfectly applicable in international relations as it is in domestic affairs, namely, never fight evil as if it was something that arose totally outside of yourself. For instance, I've just been saying how awful it is what is going on in the Soviet Union in terms of civil liberties. But for how many years were we supporting the suppression of those same civil liberties in the Philippines under Marcos? And how many other juntas, how many other governments in Central America, or in Pakistan, or in South Korea today, do we see the repression of the same civil liberties supported by the United States? In other words, we are accomplices in the very evil we abhor. What is so neat is that we were able to back off from Duvalier. We were able to back off finally from Bolton. I think Reagan handled the whole Philippine situation in the last couple of weeks exceedingly well. But up to then, of course, we had been accomplices in the suppression of civil liberties abroad in the same way the Soviet Union suppresses civil liberties at home. When you think of what they're doing south of the border in Afghanistan, you have to say that's dreadful. And you know it's dreadful because we had our war in Vietnam too, and we're about to start another one south of our border. We understand how superpowers behave with countries just south of the border. In other words, if we're not one with the Soviet Union in love, at least we're one with them in sin, which is no mean bond because it precludes the possibility of separation through judgment. In other words, it takes away the worst thing in international affairs, and that is self-righteousness. Nothing locks nations into their present terrible predicament worse than self-righteousness. I can picture a summit meeting. I get so desperate sometimes I lie awake and fantasize this way, you know. Gorbachev and Reagan meet, and Gorbachev says, "Mr. Reagan, you have said terrible things about me, but you don't know the half of it as you see in the United States. And let me tell you about some of the horrible..." And Reagan interrupts him and says, "Mr. Gorbachev, you don't realize the number of people under 18 years of age, namely 13.8 million, have sunk below the poverty line, most of them while I was in office." And they begin with a little confession of sin on both sides. Now, confession is very good for the national soul, as well as it is for the personal soul. What a terrific summit meeting that would be if you got started in that fashion. And then maybe if you manage to get that self-righteousness out of the way and the fear that fuels it, you might begin to realize the Soviet Union looks quite differently. To me, the most striking thing about the Soviet Union is that it's the only country in the world presently surrounded by hostile communist countries. That's a pretty important way of looking at the Soviet Union. You don't read that in the New York Times or even the Boston Globe very often, but I think that's a very true way of looking at it. There are many different things that come to it. In any case, there are four possible relationships that you can have with the Soviet Union. Hot war, cold war, détente and entente. And I guess we've had them all. We had hot war in 1917, 1918. Then we had cold war throughout the 1920s until Roosevelt came to power in 1933 and recognized the Soviet Union. And we had a form of détente then. And then in World War II, we had entente. And then after World War II under McCarthy, when McCarthyism was playing such an important role, we had the Cold War again. And then under Nixon and Kissinger, we had a kind of détente. And then Reagan came to power and we had the Cold War again. I think the thing that basically we all have to understand is what Martin Luther King said. It's either co-annihilation or coexistence. And I'll tell you what worries me more than anything else. What bothers me. Now, again, I get back from the kind of religious perspective on the evils of pride. Here we are, 40 years after World War II, and the whole situation has changed dramatically. World War II, we worried that this part of the globe wouldn't be able to protect itself against that part. Now it's the whole that can't protect itself against the part. In World War II, nations at war targeted each other. Now the whole world lives on the target of World War III, right? And the whole world is now as a prisoner in a cell awaiting the uncertain moment of execution. And in that situation, these two superpowers think they have a complete right to decide the fate of the world just between them. They don't need any mediation whatsoever. And that we Americans allow them to think that, and that the rest of the world is not up in arms, you might say, protesting that mediation is necessary if you two people can't do any better than that, is to me one of the most discouraging things about our time. Now, there is an offer of mediation, as many of you know, the so-called Five-Continent Initiative. In the Western Hemisphere, it's Argentina and Mexico. And then in Europe, it's Papandreou, Greece, and Sweden, and Tanzania, and Gandhi in India. The six nations have offered to mediate at any moment at Geneva to make themselves useful in any way. You never even read about that in this country. You don't even read about it. And the fact that the two superpowers that just can go on talking this way without accepting any kind of mediation is to me it's just absolutely inexcusable. It represents a kind of pride and it represents a kind of passivity on the folk who are allowing themselves to live on the target of World War III without raising a finger. Terrible commentary on both sides. And, of course, our relations with the Soviet Union get back to the whole justice issue with which it started. Because Lord knows the amount of money that we are spending on the arms race and conventional weapons as well as nuclear weapons is, of course, directly one direct reason factor why the poor are getting poorer. There's no low-income housing now whatsoever. No money from the federal government for low-income housing. And to say that this is good policy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, to make them suffer more and more, to let their poor children die more and more, is a terrible way of thinking of that. Think of that's a good way to do business. As well as an impractical one. They're not about to buckle under any more than we would buckle under. And, of course, whenever the enemy is stage center, the poor are always huddling in the wings. There's no way that the poor are going to get much attention as long as you got an enemy there. And, of course, that raises the difficult question, which I don't know how to answer. Could we survive as a society without an enemy? Could the Soviet Union survive as a society without an enemy? So that moving that enemy off stage center may prove a lot more difficult than a lot of people think. But it seems to me that this is the kind of way that a religious person could legitimately think about the world. And of course, you don't have to be religious to think about this. Just have a little bit of warmth and concern for your fellow human beings, and I think, and you have to worry at least about some of these concerns, whether you come out with the same solutions or not. All right, well, I was told that customarily 35 minutes was the limit, and I think I just about reached the limit. So why don't I stop, and then we have questions and answers and short sermons and anything you want to talk about. Okay? Yes, sir.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you'd like to address what's your relationship with the lawyers who represented you, who was in charge, whether there are any issues between you and lawyers.
Yeah, that's hard to. Try and keep that one real brief. I found when I was on the stand, I was arrested several times in civil rights, and then see 3 weeks with Ben Spock on trial here in Boston. I hated that whole system. I wanted to be able to sit there and say to the jury, this is the way it happened from my point of view. And instead, you have to jump through the hoops, you know. First say yes or no. Well, you know, I'm not that much of a scholar, but I know when yes or no is not an adequate answer, you know. And it just seemed to me to be much easier. And I stand in West Germany now, they're experimenting with things like this. The judge simply says, all right, now tell me what happened. It says it, tell it to the jury. And that's a much easier way to do it in some way. That was one of the greatest frustrations I had. Another frustration is that the law simply did not hold in civil rights days. The only reason the Warren Court was called controversial is because the judges were so gutless underneath. You had some brilliant exceptions to that in the federal court, Johnson in Montgomery. Quite extraordinary. Then there was Wright and Skelly Wright over in Mississippi. There were some exceptional judges there, but you wouldn't believe the level of the judges that we went to, had to go up against in Montgomery, Alabama. I remember Judge Marks. Of course, he was very friendly. But I remember Lou Pollack, who was then a constitutional law professor at Yale, was arguing for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And Lou has not got very good terminal facilities, and is a good lawyer anyhow. You know, he keeps thinking of something else to keep adding. And the judge finally said, Counselor, are you going to come to the end of that sentence? And he said, I'm so glad you asked that, sir, because if that was, matter of fact, was exactly what I intended to do, if, with your permission, I might simply about that, whether, you know. So I was feeling a little bit for the judge at that point, you know. But then at the end, you know, he just, out of hand, just sentenced us all and sentenced Wyatt T. Walker to something he wasn't even charged with. And even the prosecutor was kind of embarrassed, and he went up to the bench and he said, Your Honor, you can't do that. And I must say, the judge did look kind of grand. He looked down and said, Son, I just did. Now, that was the level of it, you know. And it wasn't until you got up to the higher reaches, the Supreme Court, before judges became judges. Now, I'm not holding that just against the legal profession. Senators weren't senators. Clergy were not clergy. You see, common integrity was made to look like courage. That's how bad it was. And, of course, the same thing in the anti-war thing. You know, we wanted to argue war crimes that were being committed. We wanted to argue the unconstitutionality of some of the bombing, that the war had never been declared. And all the judge wanted to argue was, you know, did you, in fact, turn in those draft cards, and were you in the room when the draft cards are turned in? And any time we tried to open it up to something bigger, the prosecutor jumped out, "Objection, Your Honor." And this old 84-year-old Judge Ford said, "Objection sustained, go forward." I can hear that one in my dreams sometimes. Go forward, you know. And it's the same thing happening out in Tucson now in the sanctuary trial. That judge will not allow the INS to carry the courtroom. Now, our position on sanctuary is that we have a perfectly good law. This isn't the fugitive slave law we're talking about. This is a perfectly good law, the 1980 Refugee Act, which embodies a lot of the 1968 protocol of the UN. And it grants asylum, political asylum, to those who have reason to fear persecution on the grounds of race, religion, creed, and so forth. And all we're arguing is that it's being miserably administered. And we can prove it. No Soviet Jew was sent back to the Soviet Union. Never. 71% of Iranians in 1983 to 85 who applied for political asylum got it. 1% of Guatemalans got it. 3% of Salvadorans got it. All right, it's clear that the whole political asylum business is highly politicized. And that it is embarrassing the United States government to call political refugees from countries whose government our own enthusiastically supports. But all that judge wants to do is to find out whether you were in the front seat behind the wheel when I was sitting in the back as an illegal alien. That's the only way you want to argue it. That, to me, is the most frustrating thing about our legal system. Every now and then it works. It worked about a year and a half ago in Vermont in the famous Winooski 44. How many have heard of the Winooski 44? You what? Is that right? Well, when I read about you and what happened there, it was written up, I was crying. It was so beautiful. You should probably be the one to say it. You correct me if I get it wrong. Anyhow, there are 44 good citizens of Vermont who decided that aid should not be given to the consuls. This is now about 2 years ago, before any humanitarian military. So they asked to see the two senators. Well, they got a good hearing from Leahy. They did not see Senator Stafford. He would not give them a hearing. And they did see Jeffers as their one representative for the great state of Vermont. That's all the folks they have up there. They only have one representative. So what did they do? They decided to sit in on Senator Stafford's office, which is in Winooski, Vermont. 44 of them, and they got arrested for, what was the official charge? Trespassing. Okay. Then the defense goes to this judge, who I gather is pretty independent, old Vermonter type, and says, we want to argue the defense of necessity, which is all of you probably know very well. It simply means, yes, we did deliberately commit a minor offense in order to forestall a greater crime from being committed. Namely, the funding of the Contras, which would have been in violation of the OAS, would have been in violation of the whole of statutes, okay? And the judge agreed to do it. So what did the jury have to hear? They had to hear about who these Contras were. And 1 hour... They had to hear about... Clark and Falk, I believe, who came up to give the international law aspect, and the judge instructed the jury and said in his closing remarks, and don't forget that international law takes precedent even over the law of the great state of Vermont. And 1 hour later, 44 good citizens, including one of them out here, walked out free. Now, that was so beautiful because it was so rare in part, right? I mean, that's the legal system working. Really working. That's the high road. And that happens so rarely that I think is my greatest frustration for the legal. But to give a quick answer. Yes. What role for lawyers? Well, I think there's, first, if you defend the poor, let me just say as a gentleman, if you're a doctor and you work in a hospital like Boston Hospital up here, I did the rounds up there once, what's it called, Boston City Hospital? Huh? Boston City Hospital. There were a lot of poor folks there. So they were nice enough. They asked me if I'd talk to all the doctors there. So I said, yeah, but I want to visit the hospital first. So I did. And there was, for instance, UBM, unidentified black man, lying there. Nobody knew who he was. And for 3 weeks, they'd kept him going. He was brain dead. I said to the nurse, how do you feel about him? I've gotten very fond of the man. I wish we could let him die. Now, if you work in a situation like that, and you see unidentified people, you see cirrhosis of the liver, which comes from hitting the bottle because your whole life is so fucked up, you know, and all. When you're living close to that, how can doctors turn out so reactionary? You know, how can they simply say, well, my only job is, you know, to put the stethoscope on him and listen to his heart, and somebody else will deal with it. Say, well, if he's got cirrhosis of the liver, then I'll diagnose the cirrhosis of the liver. And I say, now what, how are you going to deal with that? Well, that's for the social worker. I mean, people who are close to the problem sometimes don't use their imagination to say, how are we going to deal with it? So I can see a lot of doctors out of that hospital really becoming very active as citizens in party politics and other things. The same thing with lawyers. There was one beautiful woman who graduated from this school not long ago. Her name is Jean Koh. Matter of fact, her brother's a doctor here in town, Korean-American. Brilliant graduate of the Harvard Law School, who's a member of Riverside Church, as a matter of fact, right now. And she went into legal aid. And, I mean, she can tell you what these problems are simply because she's dealing with these people all the time. 55 clients a week if she's lucky. More like 75 or 80 most of the time. And she sees all these problems. Simply to get exposed to these problems, you know, is very, very important. Do some pro bono work or sleep in a shelter, volunteer from a food pantry, something like that. Just so you, nothing supplies the defect to first-hand experience. I think that's the most important thing. You can get some first-hand experience of it. You'll find various ways to do it. Now, legally, if you work in a public defender program, if you work in a legal aid program, you certainly can begin to do that. But when it comes to fighting on the justice front, there's not very much going now. I mean, there are those who, what's his name, that guy who dropped out of Airedale, Whippet and Pug, in order to take on the homeless of New York. Huh? Know his name? Hayes, Bob Hayes, right. Neat guy. Now, Bob Hayes took on the whole damn city, you know, with this thing. You know? And he's got a few people working with him now who are trying to keep the standards of the city up every Christmas. We go through, you know, the same routine. Because the public is more sensitive at Christmas time and the mayor is more sensitive to what the public has to say. So every Christmas we go take visits and we bring new lawsuits and things like that. But even that's hardly justice, you see. That's just trying to maintain the basic minimum. How you make the fight for low-income housing, that's basically a political fight, I think. And I think most of this fight has to be done politically. Immigration, if you're an immigration lawyer, you learn an awful lot of things you wouldn't learn otherwise. But I think the real fight on the justice front has to be more political. And that's where the doctors, and that's where the lawyers, and that's where the clergy have to get together to make a common political fight to change things, to get money for low-income housing, to make sure food is recognized as well. The one good thing you can say today is the right wing has gone national. And the progressive folk are all local. And you can find them in city councils, all over the place. You can find them. Here's a doctor, and there's a lawyer, and there's a clergy person, and things like that, you know. And the hope is that something is going to happen on the local level. We'll find new ways of doing things, of getting public and private money together in a more creative fashion, and then we'll be able to translate that onto a national legislation platform, and then the progressives one day, hopefully, will get back into Washington with something new to offer. Yes, sir.
What do you think of
Gunnery? There are two ways to be rich. One is to have a lot of money, and the other is to have few needs. I tend to favor the second. But I think I wouldn't be dogmatic and say, you know, this is the limit for everyone. My hope would be that if you can appreciate your second... I was going to say shirt, and then I looked at you. Obviously, you don't appreciate shirts. If you... I met this guy in gunnery school 22 years ago, right? If you appreciate a second pair of sneakers as much as you do the first pair, keep them. If the third pair of sneakers doesn't mean that much to you, forget it. I used to have a father-in-law who could eat about, he ate about a lobster a day. At first I was quite shocked. But then he ate every lobster as if it were his first or his last. And I found it hard to be critical. That seemed to me a better way to go about it. Now, the moment he began to think lobster's not that good, at that moment I would have immediately suggested filet of sole. But it's true that what I'm getting at is that I think rich people would find that if their financial resources were in fact not so renewable, their spiritual resources would become more so. Finally, spiritual resources are only, finally, the only renewable ones. And I just think people tend to be happier, more decent, more together with other people, loving, if they're not as separated by their money. I would argue that money, or private property, is a little bit like the clothes with which Adam and Eve were clothed. If we lived in a sinless world, we could live naked with each other, as it were, using that story now as the kind of symbol for what I want to say. But in a sinful world, too much, too close, leads to an excess of imperialism. I identify you with me. Or an excess of submission, I identify myself with you. So we need to be distant a little bit. Not to keep us apart, but in order to facilitate our coming together in a better way. And clothes that are supposed to do that. Now, if clothes, in fact, keep us further apart from each other, it's all over. Private property is good to the degree that it recognizes the frailty of our life together. And private property is there to enhance our life together. But if it instead, it simply magnifies our apartness, that's all. That's the way I sort of feel basically about money, clothes, private property, all those things. Does that help at all? Yes, and then you.
What political measures do you think are for achieving economic justice, such as water ownership or mass redistribution?
Well, I like to retreat before questions like that and say, my job as a preacher is to say, let justice roll down like mighty waters, and it's up to Barney Frank and the rest of the folk down in Washington to figure out the irrigation system. I recognize that that's not very adequate. But the basic measures that I would favor would be whatever it takes to get decent housing for all folk. And Robert Taft, way back in 1949, I think, with the Taft Housing Act, said the one thing that the private sector cannot supply is low-income housing. That has to be a responsibility of the public sector. That's Mr. Conservative, as he was called in those days, Senator Robert Taft. And I think that that's absolutely true. Now, how you get low-income housing, you know, I'm now getting so desperate in New York that I'm going to start, I think, in a couple of weeks with trying to get the 30,000 millionaires together with some 30,000 homeless and get money out of the top end of the economic ladder to help the bottom one, because the millionaires could do it like you'd go out and buy a pack of cigarettes if you smoke, and they'd get lots of publicity, and, you know, this would be a civic thing, et cetera, et cetera. But that's charity. That's not a very, it's an imaginative way to go for the moment, and we ought to get the city to put some money in as a recognition of the city's responsibility, or the state. But exactly how you'd get that low-income housing, I don't know. Exactly how you get the decent kind of education so we don't have 50% dropouts in New York City, I don't claim to know either, but that is very serious. And when we don't give people access to jobs by job training, or by doing the old British system of paying them for a year to work in a company, hopefully the company then will want to continue them after a year. What way you go, I really don't feel I'm qualified. I certainly would change the tax base of New York City. And I think that would be one issue around which you might be able to build quite a large political constituency. Yes, sir, you and then you.
Before World War II, only 5% of the American people paid income tax. And during World War II, there was a big increase in both corporate and individual income taxes. And since the end of World War II, there has been a tremendous reduction in corporate taxes and a shifting of the burden onto low and middle income, so that by 1970, over 80% of the American people were paying income tax. And that income tax law that was put into effect during World War II, to pay for World War II, has been used to fund the arms race and intervention, killing millions of people all over the world. And my question is, why hasn't the peace movement come out to abolish the World War II income tax system? Because that is the system, that is what pays for the arms race and the intervention that has been going on for the past four decades.
Well, I confess to you, that's the first time I've heard that suggestion. I mean, you hear the general suggestion of, you know, taking money from the arms race and putting it into human needs, but to attack the income tax system as a better way to get at it makes good sense. I think the answer is because more people like me haven't thought about these things enough, and the people who do think about them more don't manage to get their thoughts out or organized in such a fashion that the movement can be built around.
I'm not suggesting that we abolish the income tax.
No, I understand what you're saying.
But what I'm saying is that the income tax system that we have came about with the 16th Amendment in 1913. At the time, only 1% of the American people paid income tax. And it was up to 5% by the end of the 1930s. But I think the corporation taxes definitely have to be increased, because at the end of World War II in 1945, about 35% of the money that went to the federal government came from a corporate tax.
Right.
And that's in the...
No, see, what's also important about what you're saying is that this might be a very good talking point to get to those super patriots in the lower middle class and in the middle class generally. The working class that has such a suspicious view of the peace movement, basically, and wants to stand tall with the president, which means stand not in greater wisdom or decency, but just power. So that might be a good talking.
The worst thing is that this tax that has gone on to the lower middle-income people has fed the right wing. The right-wing politicians go around screaming against taxes, and they get the support of working people, and they get into power and stay into power, and they use...
Have you written something on this?
Yes, I have.
Yeah? Something that wouldn't take me 2 weeks to read, and now it'd be as clear as you're talking. Could you send that to me?
I'll give it to you now. You can get it.
Terrific.
Anybody else want a copy?
I love it. Every crowd has somebody like that. You know, you always go walk away far more educated when you're on. Yes.
Okay. Two-part question dealing with housing. Should a church which helps refugees, is involved with the sanctuary movements, if such a church houses refugees, at least temporarily, in its within the church itself, in the church building, should it also be morally required, if not legally required, to do the same for the homeless and not make a distinction between the two? And secondly, what about somebody such as myself, for example, a former New Yorker, wouldn't mind returning there? What about people who come between two stools? They're not desperately poor, but they're kind of not poor enough for shelters, but they're not having too many possessions for them, but they're not... You know, they just can't afford a housing in Manhattan, but not even the rest of the city. What do you think? Do you have any ideas about what should we get about that area? Because that's more complex in a way.
Well, a couple of them. First of all, we have a shelter, and we house therefore 10 times as many of the homeless as we do refugee families. And I think that is something. You know, just like it's so easy to get excited about what's going on in the Philippines, and we should be excited about. South Africa, but we mustn't let that detract us from what's going on at home. So that's to take care of your first question. The thing that I'm drawn to is the whole Section 8 approach, you know, which doesn't separate the poor folk from the rich folk, but underwrites housing for the poor folk. I would think very minimally that every time one of these real estate guys like Trump is granted permission to build expensive income housing, that he would have to also build a certain percentage of low-income housing. So that'd be one way you could go with it. Certainly, then, you can use taxes in that fashion. I mean, tax rebate. If you know New York and Manhattan, 57th Street, between 57th and 58th Street, on Fifth Avenue has the most expensive stores and towers and has the greatest tax abatement of any other block in New York. Tax abatement in New York City has been used to favor the rich. It has not been used to favor either small storekeepers to keep them there in some way, or to low-income housing, anything like that. My own, I think we're much better off when rich and poor don't live so separate as they do. I feel a great sense of gratitude that I live on 125th Street. And none of us are very rich, but there are a lot of folk who are poor, and it gives you a sense of reality, and gives you some sense of neighborhood. Park Avenue is the most sterile avenue in the whole damn country, I think. I wouldn't want to live on Park Avenue, and I don't think anybody should want to live on a place like that. It's just unhealthy, I think. Spiritually, it's bad. But beyond that, that's the main thing, I guess, I feel about how housing we ought to go about housing.
If they use Section 8 in Cambridge to undermine rent control, because people under Section 8 can landlords can have them move into apartments that would otherwise be rented at rent controlled levels, and get a market value rent paid for by the government.
Again, if the American people simply knew that the American people think that in Carter's day and before, the government was playing an enormous role in helping poor people with their housing. Now, if you put in the indirect subsidies that go with non-payment of taxes on mortgages, then the greatest government help went to those at $50,000 or more, who were earning $50,000 or more. The whole tax system was aiding the rich. And this is the thing that you just keep running into, I think, again and again. It's like the whole legal system aids the rich. I mean, and from the beginning, you know. And I have a parishioner who was in the Columbia Law School. And she went to the law school with a $35,000 debt. I said, my God, how are you ever going to pay that one off? He said, I'll do it in a year. Well, I said, then you're forced, though, to go into an expensive law firm. Yes, I'll have to go into an expensive law firm to do it. Okay. And that's not right either. Everything forces, you know, people into one direction. They all get tracked, psychologically tracked, economically tracked, and every other way. We probably ought to take a couple more and then wind up. What are you going to say?
Question. First of all, I'm curious what your reaction is to that millionaire who set up the fund for one of the public schools in New York, or one of the individual classes in New York. Do you think that's a good idea and the sort of thing that ought to be continued as a way of improving public education? And the second question is whether you feel that the focus in American society on individual rights is perhaps misplaced as opposed to individual duties towards the common good of the republic.
First, to take the first one, I don't know how many of you know, there was a millionaire in New York who went, he was invited, successful man, to come back and talk to, was it the sixth grade? I think it was the sixth grade, yeah, it was the one through six. And while he was there, it suddenly occurred to him to say to those students, I will personally pay the way of any one of you in this class when you go to college, if you go to college. And damned if all of them had that incentive, and their parents there, you know, he wrote it down, and then he would write to them during the 8th grade, 9th grade, 11th grade, encouraging them all along, you know, said, I'm getting ready for you, I'm keeping money for you, and other parents were behind him. I mean, you had to say it was a rather creative individual step. And you had to say that it gave a lot of hope to many individuals. And it got families where they're supposed to be, pushing the kid now to get ahead and to get into college, because there was hope now. There was hope. In that sense, it was terrific. Now, to expect all of society to run that way, obviously, is wrong. But at least as an individual imaginative act, I thought it was just terrific. I wrote him a big fan letter. So, on that. As for the second question, which was... Oh, yeah, individual, right. I remember when you graduated from college, you probably got your degree, you know, and you tried to remember which hand goes where. And then you were admitted to all its rights and privileges, the way the old expression went. And then I remember at Yale, Hingham Brewster used to say, I admit you to all its rights and responsibilities, you know. Well, he was right, you know. You should be response-able, able to respond to the needs of society. And fundamentally, education, the old-fashioned view of education was supposed to make us better. That's a discarded view, except perhaps at the Harvard Law School, but I would doubt it. And in that sense, there was, and of course, the original colleges were to train people to be public servants. And the whole notion of freedom of our forebears, and right up to the time of Lincoln's inaugural, when he said, a new call for a new birth of freedom, he didn't mean you're free to be greedy. Freedom in those days was practically synonymous with virtue. A rebirth of virtue, what he had in mind. And it's what all those people at the time of the revolution had in mind when they talked about freedom. Now, I don't know how we're going to recreate that atmosphere, and whether there are certain things that we shouldn't be doing to help people, like obligatory service, not in the military. I haven't wanted to get behind national service because it's just another way of bringing in the draft. But if they drop the draft and say everybody reaching a certain age has to do some kind of public service, and they'd allow us folks to decide what constituted public service rather than the government, so that you could get some people in some radical ways of doing things, then that maybe that could be an interesting way of trying to regenerate that old spirit. But what I do feel very strongly right now is that the leadership in this country, in our leading schools, is not going to be helpful. I know that Yale graduates are far more part of the problem than they are part of the solution. I was talking at Yale, they invite me back from time to time, and I said to the students there, I said, you know, it's very funny to me, because when I was here, I knew hundreds and hundreds of you, loved you dearly, and many of you were nice enough to love me back. In fact, some of you even said I had quite a profound influence on your life. But I never see you anymore. You know, we got one-year graduates join Riverside Church. Not that that's necessarily any criterion, but he's a neat guy. He started the gay caucus, which got the Yale alumni quite upset. But when we're doing things like, when we're talking about things like housing, go to meetings and things like that, and trying to stop intervention, trying to stop Congress from joining Reagan and waging war against the Senate, and he says, you don't run into Ivy School graduates. Ramsey Clark, when I talked to him about it, I said, where do you get the people to help you work? He said, not Harvard, Brooklyn. Now that grieves me, because the talent in the Ivy League is so enormous, and particularly, I'd have to say, in my humble opinion, in the law school. Now, Yale is no question about it. If you want to talk about sheer intellectual power, competence, intellectual competence, and kind of psychological competence, you had to say the law school's got it. Couldn't say divinity school has it. Couldn't say the graduate school's got it in terms of, graduate schools, like academics, there's a combination of being very egotistical and very shy, which is not quite the kind of competence. So the law school, they're egotistical, but they're not shy. That's the difference. But, you know, there's competence there, you know. One, I don't know what it's going to take to get more folks out of these, out of schools like this one to join this problem, because you got the competence, and as lawyers, you'll be so much more effective than us poor parsons can be. All right, let's take one more question from the back row, and then somebody will wind it up. And
then... Nicaragua is only one person in the series, on
I hear what you're saying. And actually, it'd be true here. You see, one of the reasons why it's so hard to get blacks into the peace movement is because the economic argument, they understand the economic arguments, and Reagan has made it very clear for a lot of them. But my black buddies, ministers like myself, in Harlem, for instance, will say, come on, Coffin. He says, after World War II, the money didn't come into Harlem, you know, when we demobilized. And after the Korean War, the money didn't come into Harlem. And after the Vietnam War, the money didn't come into Harlem. So what's the guarantee that if we, you know, stop the arms race now, the money would come into Harlem? It works on this side, as I understand it works on your side. The thing that seems to me, however, to be true, where I would, you know, wonder a little bit about what you said, the Warsaw Pact is the thing that's the main instrument to sort of keep everything in order. And what keeps the Warsaw Pact going if not NATO? You see, our hawks feed your hawks over there. I understand what you're saying on that, but as far as the arms race go, and I'm not saying we should unilaterally disarm, though I think it's very important that seeing we have unilaterally escalated every time, it wouldn't hurt us one little bit to unilaterally de-escalate. And I like what Gorbachev did with his test ban treaty, and I grieve that we didn't follow it up. And I grieve that the papers in this country and the media did nothing about it, you know. There is a conspiracy in the original sense of conspiracy, meaning to breathe together. The press in this country does breathe together. This is a parenthetical remark. I'll get back to that. There is a kind of breathing together that goes on in this country, so that we've now bought into Marxist-Leninist. This is the only way you refer to the Sandinistas. And that you've got to be very wary of any test ban suggestion that comes out of the Soviet Union, because after all, they are not trustworthy. There is this kind of conspiracy that goes on. I had a couple of Soviets. I speak very good Russian, so I see a good deal of Soviet. And they came to me once. Are you from Hungary? Yeah? I thought. I have a thing. I love Hungarians. I thought I recognized the accent. They said, как вы американцы это делаете? How do you Americans do it? And they've just come out of the Middle West, so I thought they were talking about our agricultural achievements, you know, and I knew that the Soviets were still eating that miracle wheat that you plant in the Ukraine that comes up in Iowa. But that wasn't what they had in mind at all. They said, как вы американцы делаете? We have been up and down, to and fro in this country, sounding just like Job. And we have read newspapers, and we have watched CBS, the NBC, the ABC. And they said, CBS, NBC, and ABC. Какая разница? What's the difference? And when you think about that 7 o'clock news, I tell you, to make a difference aside from personality difference between Rather and Jennings and Brokaw, you know, you'd have to get the thinnest piece of paper in the world to make a difference between a point of view or even what's being reported, for heaven's sake. And the same is true in editorial policies. In most papers in this country, the Boston Globe being somewhat of an exception to that, along with Louisville Courier and a few others that you could come up with. But there is a kind of samizdat in this country. If you really want to know what's going on in Central America, you're not going to get it by reading Time, Newsweek, New York Times very much. You really have to read the NACLA, the stuff that's put out by some of the solidarity groups, or small religious papers. Or maybe some leftist papers like Nation or something like that. But to come back to this, and we'll finish with this. See, I think our hawks love their hawks. And their hawks love our hawks. And I can imagine a conversation that took place before the invasion of Afghanistan. When their hawks said to their doves, all these are relative terms, I understand, that what's detente accomplished for us? Nothing. So, we don't want to have all these ayatollahs screaming across our borders here, and we've got to keep our borders secure, South, so we'll just go in and we'll have a quick six-month operation. But in other words, their hawks probably were able to show their doves that they thought hadn't accomplished anything for them. And our hawks need their hawks to stay hawkish. So that, and Warsaw Pact needs NATO. Now, if we were to start dismantling on both sides, the dissidents, I think, would do better in the Soviet Union, in Hungary, and Romania, and in Poland. Because at least there'd be less moral underpinnings for any kind of military intervention. And I can't help thinking that the Soviets learned a lesson in Czechoslovakia in 68, which they tried not to repeat in Poland. And they don't know what to do about Poland, except don't go in with the tanks. But I think that détente is the best hope for dissidents behind the Iron Curtain. In any case, détente is the best hope to save this whole world, which if we continue this way, is certainly going to be blasted in the kingdom come in a very short time. And probably by error. By some kind of failure on the part of computer technology in the Soviet Union, which has gone to a launch upon warning strategy because cruise missiles and Pershing 2s take only about 6 minutes to go from Europe to the capital, so they have to rely on their computer technology, and their computer technology we know is inferior to our computer technology, and our computer technology is imperfect, but we're very careful not to sell them our better computer technology for reasons of national security. And that's as crazy as the whole thing is fast becoming, you know. And pretty soon when they can make bombs the size of baseball and hide them in diplomatic pouches or in the tutus of the Bolshoi Ballet, and when Puerto Rico Libre has its own little bombs, you can imagine what the police measures are going to be called for in this country to protect our citizens from private nuclear terrorism. Am I making myself clear? All the time we start thinking about Star Wars, this is going to be taking place on the ground. That's why I think it's absolutely got to stop. Absolutely got to stop. And if the only thing that's preventing us from really moving now is Gorbachev, what I happen to think is serious about wanting economic reform and knows that he can't do it until he gets some money, and the only place he can get some money is out of the military. And I think that they are scared to death of Europe and the United States and China. And at least we'll never know how serious they are until we take them up on it. But if we don't finally use a bargaining chip for its purposes to bargain, boy, it's disgusting. And I'm really impressed by an editorial I read on the way up here, which asked, will the churches have the guts to stand up in the United States and say the enemy's proposal is much closer to our own desires than the reactions of our own government? That's what may well be called for. And if we're not going to have any reaction to Gorbachev because of Star Wars, our great bargaining chip, which, and if you know the history of bargaining chips, you know it's all chips and no bargain. And to want to go ahead with Star Wars is to me just the height of insanity. And the Soviets had come up with it, boy, we would have called it for what it is. It is a refusal to be deterred, and therefore an undermining of deterrence. And to say that's all peaceful, you know, it's all defensive, we would never buy that if they came up with it. And they're not buying it. And Europeans are not fooled by it. Nobody's fooled by this except us. Because we're so passive in this country. You know? We're so unpatriotic. We want the comfort of opinion without the discomfort of thought. And that we allow President Reagan to get away with things that Carter never would he be allowed to get away with. Never! But Reagan, you know, the press thinks Reagan, you know, what can you do? And the passivity in this country on the arms race, it's pretty damn disgusting, just as it is on the issue of justice. But I keep hoping that graduates of Harvard Law School will get bored with being bored and will join the struggle and have a much more interesting life. Okay, thank you very much.